Hey, Rick, just so I can get the sound right on my end, can you just tell me what you had for breakfast this morning?
Sure. I woke up 15 minutes ago, stumbled past a box of moon pies, got a glass of water, and I'm sitting here looking at you.
Hey, y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. And that was Rick Bragg, just waking up and sitting down to talk to us. Bragg has a Pulitzer Prize, a slew of best-selling books, and a lifetime of Southern stories spilling out of his head. He's got a new book out, a collection of columns called Where I Come From. And we ended up talking a lot about where he's gone back to. Since the pandemic, he's been living with his mother back in their little corner of northeastern Alabama. He's thought a lot about where he belongs, not just in body, but in spirit. And he made me think about where the South has been and where it might be headed and how to sort out the best of our past without forgetting the worst of it. Here's our conversation. As we talk this morning, it looks like Joe Biden is going to be president. And it looks like Georgia was one of the key states that may have put him over the top. Now, I was born and raised there. I know you spent a lot of time there. I wonder what your thoughts are on what this means about the South politically and otherwise.
Well, I think if I was sitting about an hour from here, across the state line. I'm only about an hour from the state line. If I were in Georgia, I would feel much better about it. If I were in Georgia, I would think that this is not an anomaly, but just part of the natural change of the state. And everybody's going to say that, and you know they're going to try to sound real smart saying it, but. One of the things I loved about living in Atlanta many years ago was how diverse it was, how different it was. I also loved the fact I lived around the corner from the Krispy Kreme donut factory. But I think it was inevitable. Spent a lot of time in Savannah for the book stuff, so I see that change, which seems odd in a city so old to think of it as, you know, being in any kind of floods. So for Georgia, I think it will become a place that Democrats can count on the national stage. Here in Alabama, not so much.
Well, I wanted to ask you, I couldn't let an Alabama man go without asking about Tommy Tuberville, who, as you well know, is the former Auburn coach who's now going to be one of y'all's senators.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts on that?
You know, you seem that there would just be enough lingering hatred to prevent an Auburn man from ascending to the senatorship. On the serious side, Doug Jones was a friend of mine. He was a fishing buddy. I don't think he was a very good fisherman, but I think he was a great senator and would have been a great senator. I think in a Biden administration, Doug will play some kind of role. He is too smart a guy and too valuable a guy. He's a true hero to a lot of people around here. He's not just some guy who decided to run for office. I think Doug's a true hero to a lot of people around here. And I think he will serve a role in the future of our state and our country. And I'll tell you a good story about Doug. We went fishing on Mobile one day and I was just burning up. You know, I'm one of them pale, pasty Southerners that just burn up out on the water. So I bought me a good hat, you know, big wide brimmed hat. And I'm bigger than Doug. So I could have thrown him into Mobile Bay to drown if I had wanted. And he still had the courage in the middle of that little bitty boat out in that water to look me in the face and say, "You know, Rick, that's a lady's hat." And I cussed him out. And then later I looked inside the band on the inside, and it said something like "Fashions for the Young Miss" or something like that. He's never let me forget it. And I still threaten to drown him.
I know that you've been riding out this pandemic, spending a lot of time, maybe all your time, with your mom. And I'm wondering, I guess, first of all, I want to know about it in more general terms, but I do wonder if y'all been having any political type discussions as all these votes have been coming in and that sort of thing.
My mama is probably the least political human being. And sometimes when you say that in the Deep South, you're saying that your political beliefs are just so private. And they're private for a reason. They're private because you would be shouted down. But my mother's such a gentle and loving nature that she would never believe the meannesses of some folks down here. She would never believe the cruelty and the meannesses in taking advantage of someone or being cruel to them because of the color of their skin or where they're from. She would never believe any of that. So politically, our only problem is that she does get a great deal of her news from TV preachers. You know, she gets a great, you know, the only thing she watches on television is TV preachers and Gunsmoke. So it's more the gospel of Miss Kitty and the gospel of Chester and Marshall Dillon that she gets a lot of her morality plays from the Virginian.
Well, I've been wondering about that in general. I've thought about what it would be like to spend every day with my mother, who I loved deeply, but I wondered what it, you know, and certainly at my age, what it would be like to spend kind of 24/7 with her. So what has that been like for you?
Well, the bottom line is that while there are moments of frustration, it's worth everything in the world to me. I can't think of anywhere I'd rather be. And I mean that because all you got to do, if you ever get to thinking, well, man, I could be doing this. Man, I could be doing that. I could be 9 miles out in the Gulf right now, you know, or I always wanted to find myself a tall, gentle horse and spend some time in Wyoming or, you know, New Mexico, places like that. But I'm not doing that. My mother is 83. My brother Sam has been ill. This is the right place for me.
I want to talk about your book a little bit, this new book that's a collection of your columns. And one of the things that struck me right from the beginning, the introduction, is that you talked about it being the gentler side of the South, the easier moments and that sort of thing. And what I wondered about that was, you know, people have been writing those types of stories for a long, long time. You're part of a long tradition that includes people like Louis Grizzard, Roy Blunt Jr., people like that. And I wonder if those people ever felt the need to kind of explain themselves a little bit in the way that you did in that introduction. I guess what I'm asking is, do you feel like the times are demanding other things of some people and you're having to sort of explain why you're writing about the particularities of the South that you're writing about?
That may be either the best question I've ever been asked or the one I've dreaded the most, one of the two. I used to write about, you know, I used to write about killing and dying. I used to write about poverty and the slow decay of cities. And, you know, I wrote about militant Islamic fundamentalism after 9/11. And I wrote about, you know, the outbreak of, well, very flawed democracies in Haiti, and wrote about the coup, and, you know, wrote a pretty bloody history and sad history. Now, I had my moments. I did go to Las Vegas and write about the slow demise of the Las Vegas showgirl. And I took a barbecue tour of North Carolina, you know, and I had some fun. But I guess I got to thinking of myself as a serious guy. You know, I thought I was a serious guy. And then, you know, you write your first books and you realize that your first books, you can write about family and still have grit. You know, as a matter of fact, they pulled stories out of my books and called them grit lit. You know, and so you think, again, you still think of yourself as a serious guy. And then later in your life, when you get a little slower, you realize that there is great value in stories that are purely the softer side of our nature. And if you're lucky, that coincides with your ability to jump and run and duck. But I guess the snobbery in me always wanted me to think of myself as a serious guy. But so many people who have read and reviewed, you know, these collections. I did one more a few years back. So many people who have reviewed these and read them said, well, this is a good antidote for the way we are now. This is a good, and you have to face, you have to hope that that's true. And you have to stop taking yourself so damn seriously. And you have to accept that maybe the best thing you can do, going back to that earlier question, maybe the best thing you can do is write a story about burying your kinfolks. Maybe the best thing you can do is write about good dogs and Tupperware. You know, maybe that's the best thing and best place for you. And that took a long time to answer that question, but it's a good question because it goes back to me not wanting to turn loose of that more serious side of myself, even as I realize nostalgia is not just a sweet, filmy thing. Nostalgia, especially for a Southerner, is a power. You know, man, it's a power. I don't mean a thing that you can exert upon somebody, but something you can share and that people recognize.
You said something that struck me about that nostalgia being so powerful. And I know you talked in the introduction of your book about your Aunt Jo and how she and other members of your family had those powerful nostalgic feelings. Now, I think most Southerners, certainly people of my generation, your generation, might agree that nostalgia can get complicated because sometimes you long for things and you forget other things. And I'm trying to, personally, try to figure out how much is it okay for me to long for, remember fondly, without pushing the rest of it out of the frame. How are you dealing with that? And how do you think your family and people like that are dealing with that?
Well, that goes back to the very first book I wrote 30 years ago. I was lucky in that my family was insulated. When the men got together to talk at a family reunion or just leaning on a shovel handle, they were of that northeastern, southerners from the northeastern part of the South who worshiped work. Politics meant very little to them. They considered all politicians to be kind of bandy-legged no-accounts. And you know, they looked at Wallace and they recognized in Wallace someone who might be closer to their heart than maybe a northeastern interloper. But they saw the flaws in Wallace. They recognized a bandy-legged populist when they saw one. And so they talked about work, you know? I guess they talked about football, but mostly they talked about work. They talked about dogs and hunting and fishing and work. They worshiped work. And a man that didn't have work was like a man that didn't have purpose or value. A man that didn't work in a cotton mill or a steel mill or didn't bale hay and tend cows was of no value. And the women, of course, were very similar. You know, they worked in sweatshops and they sewed uniforms at Fort McClellan, but they also raised these beautiful gardens, you know, and babies. And so I was free of that ridiculous, ridiculous bull of racial hatred. I was mostly free of it. I encountered it at the grocery store. I saw it in the classroom. But my people just, by God, had too much to do.
When we come back, Rick Bragg talks about the dog that showed up in his life and gave him what he needed, although not exactly what he hoped for.
You know, instead of getting one of them gentle dogs that come up and lay their, you know, head on your leg and, you know, just, you know, sit there and stare into your eyes. And I got this awful, terrible, destructive.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Hey, y'all. If you're looking for another podcast about Southern identity and how work defines it, I recommend listening to WFAE's newest podcast. It's called Work It. If you're from North Carolina, you might remember Work It being the winner of the 2019 Queen City PodQuest, where more than 300 podcast pitches were submitted and voted on by the community. On each episode of Work It, hosts Stephanie Hale and Jill Bieres follow their curiosities underneath the job and into the complex identities of the people we encounter in our everyday lives. From carpet layers to lawyers, barbers to burlesque performers, and beyond. Gain a new perspective on work and life. Listen to Work It. It's on Apple Podcasts, NPR One, and WFAE.org/workit. And now, back to our conversation with Rick Bragg.
Rick, you talk in this book all the way through, you kind of come across from time to time people who you've either talked to or written about in one way or another, a lot of the sort of the icons of the South, like Pat Conroy, Billy Graham, Jerry Lee Lewis, who of course you wrote a whole book about. I wonder, to kind of take the fishing metaphor a little bit, if there's ever been a big one that got away for you. Somebody that you look back on and wish, man, I wish I had gotten to talk to that person a little more or had a shot at them and missed it, or any of that sort of thing?
Oh, man, God, yeah, we don't even have time. Even on a podcast, we don't even have time. Well, let's start with the white whale. You know, the one that the white whale for me was Dolly Parton.
Me too.
I always wanted, well, first off, from the time I was 11, I was in love with Dolly. You know, I saw on the TV, I just fell madly in love with Dolly. And Dolly was timeless, you know? I mean, Dolly was timeless. So I continued to be in love with her throughout my life. And then I found out, holy cow, Dolly was a good person. You know, Dolly bought books by the train car load, you know, and put them in the hands of kids. So that's my noble reason for wanting to.
Not the only reason, but a noble reason.
No, yeah, that was my noble reason. But I would have liked to have done the book on Bryant. You know, Paul Bear Bryant. Because I think there have been so many good books, and I own about all of them, you know, that have been written about Bryant. But I'd like to have done the definitive, no holds barred, a book on Bryant in a magical world where you could write that book and not be hit with a rock when you try to pull out of the Piggly Wiggly parking lot. You know, I've got plenty to do. And the world is not set up for that kind of book. The sports world is not set up for that kind of book.
Speaking of plenty to do, my understanding is you're working on a book about your dog.
Oh, man.
Tell me about it.
Oh, man. Well, he should be in here. I should go get him. But he's out right now terrorizing a cat somewhere. But he... About 3 years ago, we live in the middle of 40 acres of mountain pasture. And it's that rugged, I don't have to explain it to you, but, you know, a lot of people in your podcast may not know that mountain pasture is different from that kind of flat, easy rolling pasture. And one day in cool weather, when it was raining and misting, I looked up the mountain, up on the ridgeline, and saw this dog just laying there in the leaves and the briars. And I went up the mountain to look at him, and he was starving to death. And he was all cut up and chewed on. And I recognized him then as a stray. People call them wild dogs, but I think they call them wild dogs just because it's easy to be cruel to them, if you call him that. But he had been tore up, a kind of an illegitimate Australian Shepherd. He looked purebred, but you know, his tail hadn't been cropped. He might have been wild a long time. And when I looked at him closer, I saw that he had a bad eye. He had the eye. It was in the socket, but it was a pure black. You know, and he had a scar across it, like a claw mark across the eye. That might have been why somebody threw him away, or that might have happened when he was out fighting. But we had seen him for months and months running the roads. You know, you'd see him miles from here in like a dump, you know, turning over garbage can or something. And I knew it was a bad idea when I went and got him, but I picked him up, brought him home. He terrorized the other dogs. He terrorized the cats. He terrorized the livestock. He made of himself such a nuisance for a full year that, you know, I considered shooting him myself. I never would, but it's fun to say. And he became my buddy, you know, and in a time when I was kind of down, I had got sick. I have non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, which is, you know, people say if you're going to get cancer, that's the one you want to have. You know? But I also had some, you know, kidney issues and heart issues and other things that I'm fine. You know, I'm in better shape, better health, and maybe not shape, than a lot of my people. But I was a little bit down, you know. First time in my life I'd ever really been hammered, you know. And you know, instead of getting one of them gentle dogs that come up and lay their, you know, head on your leg and, you know, just, you know, sit there and stare into your eyes. And I got this awful, terrible, destructive dog. And I just realized, you know, and again, I don't claim to be real smart. I mean, you know, like a lot of Southerners, I can put a story together. You know, I can do that. I can kind of piece a story together. But I've never claimed to be brilliant. But I did figure out that there are days in this life where you need a good dog. But there are a lot of days when you need a bad one. You know, a bad dog will fill up a day. You know, a bad dog will fill up a day. And I got the best bad dog in the whole world. So, yeah, I finished that book just. Literally put the finishing touches on it just a few days ago. It'll run next fall, next October.
What's the dog's name and what's the book's name?
It's the best dog name in the whole history of all dogs of all time. He, being an Australian Shepherd, he has copper points on his white face. It just freckles. And my grandfather had nicknamed a homely cousin of ours to make her feel better about having so many freckles. He nicknamed her the Speckled Beauty. And my mother, you know, took a long, lingering look at my dog and said, "Well, we'll call you the Speckled Beauty." So we call him Speck for short. The book title will be The Speckled Beauty.
Rick, I want to ask you one last thing, and I'll let you go.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of us from the South and in other places too always wonder what it would be like in our, you know, later years or whatever to go back home. What do you want to tell us about what it's like? What the good parts, the bad parts, the things to look out for, the things that make you feel good about it?
Yeah, we could do another day on that, I think. But I think it's what you were looking for. You know, I'm 61, which is not quite dead yet. And I've done pretty much everything I ever wanted to do. I got to see a camel train going across the horizon in Central Asia. I got to sit in a Land Rover and stare down a mountainside at a big bull elephant, you know, in Africa. I got to see crocodiles eat a wildebeest. I got to hear a holy man's call to prayer drifting over the desert. And I got to see the uglier part of things. I got to see the Klan marching in support of a lynched man in Texas. Completely bungled, you know, my personal life problem, you know. You should never trust a Southern boy with his own personal life. And so I did what I wanted to do and messed up things I shouldn't have and hurt people I shouldn't have. And But I can't say that I led any humdrum life, and I think I may be stealing that from somebody else. But I never wanted to do the things a lot of people wanted to do. I can live without ever seeing the Greek Isles. You know, I can live without ever finding the perfect bistro. You know, I like pinto beans and ham. You know, I like largemouth bass. I like, what feral sounds call it, the whisper of the river. I like the whisper of the river. I like to hear people talk about my people. So I'm not missing anything by being here. I think if you are, or if there is an ache or a gnawing in your gut to see things that you didn't see, then I can understand how home would be like a too tight shirt. You know what I mean? Be like church clothes. Home would always feel like church clothes. Well, I didn't go to church that much, you know, and what would have happened if I had been chasing those things and heard by a long distance that I had to come home and bury one of my people? So I ain't never claimed to be a good guy, but there are things that I have to do, you know, and maybe to make up for the things I didn't do, you know. So I think you come home, I think you come home because it feels right. You know, if it feels like a, you know, at my age, and maybe it's the same with you, there ain't nothing better in the whole world than having a shirt that fits right or a pair of shoes that don't bind. And that's the way home feels to me.
We've all been living with split personalities lately. So much is going on in the outside world. A historic election, a pandemic, marches in the streets. But because of the virus, so many of us have experienced all this extremely close to home. Either staying at the house all day or ducking in and out like gophers. It's hard to calibrate sometimes which world you should care about at which moment. The trick Rick Bragg discovered long ago is that one world comments on the other. How we treat our kin says something, or should say something, about how we treat the larger human family. The values we learned at the kitchen table ought to help us navigate a complicated life outside it. That's not laying it on thick, although Rick Bragg does have some cane syrup in his voice. It's more an understanding of what matters on either side of the front door and trying to live a life that lets in the air. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our audience engagement producer is Joni Deutsch. Our main theme music comes from Josh Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on the NPR One app, iTunes, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also find Southbound on WFAE.org, where each episode has show notes with more information on that week's guest. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.